welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's first page, the first headline is Widow of Anamosa Officer Killed by Inmates Files Lawsuit. McFarland filed suit after no charges were made following brutal killings. No changes were made, excuse me, following brutal killings at the prison by Trish Mahaffey. Sarah Montague McFarland doesn't want another family to get the call she did March 23, 2021, saying her husband, a correctional officer at Anamosa State Penitentiary, had been hurt. Minutes later, she was told, "I'm so sorry, he didn't make it." "I dropped the phone and screamed no," Sarah told the Gazette on Tuesday. "My teen son screamed no. I just cried for a long time." She had little details for hours. She knew her husband, Robert McFarland, 46, and a registered nurse, Lorena Schulte, 50, of Cedar Rapids, had been attacked by inmates and had died. She also knew Lori Mathis, a prison dental assistant, had been taken hostage. Sarah wanted to go to the hospital, but she couldn't. The hospital was on lockdown because of the pandemic. She didn't think about arguing because she was in shock. One of her sons drove her home, and she called Robert's parents. Family and friends started coming over after they heard the news reports. "The rest is a blur," she said, tearing up at times, thinking back to that day when her and their three sons' lives changed forever. It wasn't until much later that day, when she talked to the officials with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, that she learned two inmates, Michael Dutcher and Thomas Woodard, had bludgeoned her husband and Schulte with metal hammers in a failed escape attempt. Sarah said she waited for officials to address safety and compliance issues that led to the murder of her husband, but nothing changed, so she filed a lawsuit Wednesday against Department of Corrections officials and prison employees because she doesn't want anyone else to be harmed or killed. The 130-page gross negligence wrongful death lawsuit filed in Jones County has 26 named defendants. The defendants are prison administration and employees, including Beth Skinner, director of the Iowa Department of Corrections, and William Spurslagi, now retired deputy director of institutions, and Jeremy Larson, the former warden of the Anamosa State Penitentiary. The suit states all the defendants had actual knowledge of the inadequate training, policies, and compliance systems of the department and the prison. The two inmates, Thomas Woodard and Michael Dutcher, who were convicted of killing Robert McFarland and Schulte, could access hammers used as weapons and a metal grinder they attempted to use to cut through metal bars because of the inadequate policies and compliance systems, the suit asserts. Woodard and Dutcher were each convicted of two counts of first-degree murder, one count each of attempted murder of McKinley Roby, an inmate who tried to help staff, and second-degree kidnapping of Mathis. Each was sentenced to two life sentences without the possibility of parole. The lawsuit describes understaffing, known equipment failures, lack of safety protocols and procedures that created dangerous situations and allowed violent inmates to access deadly weapons. The Iowa Department of Corrections declined to comment on the lawsuit. Stephanie Schulte, the mother of murdered nurse Lorena Schulte, filed a gross negligence wrongful death lawsuit in January. It names Anamosa State Penitentiary Warden Jeremy Larson and 10 other officials as defendants. Schulte's first lawsuit, filed in April 2021, was dismissed last year because the nurse's estate was inadvertently closed. The petition contends the prison and department officials had been warned about safety issues at the prison, including radios not working, understaffing of correction officers, attempted escapes, prison nurses being held hostage, and not enough employees to respond to emergencies. Also on today's front page, Hill's school closure prompts talk of changing districts, but some favor staying with the higher-ranked Iowa City district, by Aaron Jordan and Alejandro Rojas. Many parents are mad the Iowa City Community School District is closing its elementary school in Hills, but that doesn't mean they want to send their kids to a lower-ranking district instead. This is despite offers from two Republican state lawmakers to help the Johnson County community move its students to another school district, such as Lone Tree. The Iowa City School District offers so many more opportunities for foreign languages, clubs, and swimming, Nancy Hebel said Monday night at a Hills City Council meeting. "I want my grandchildren to go to the number one high school in the state, not the 139th. U.S. News & World Report ranked Iowa City West number one in the state and 398th in the nation. Iowa City Liberty is ranked 6th and Iowa City High ranked 12th. The Lone Tree High School is number 139 out of 317 ranked Iowa high schools on the list. The Iowa City School Board decided last month to close Hills Elementary at the end of this school year to save the district about $1.66 million toward the $7.5 million leaders need to cut over the next 2 years. Only about 40 of the 100 students enrolled at Hills this year live in Hills. The rest are bused from the southern part of Iowa City or unincorporated areas of Johnson County. Senator Dawn Driscoll, Republican of Williamsburg, and Representative Heather Hora, Republican of Washington, met with the Hills City Council last week to talk about the possibility of changing school boundaries to move Hills students to the Lone Tree Community School District. Hora said she and Driscoll, both running for re-election this year, had talked with the Lone Tree School District leaders who were interested in the idea. "We wanted to bring it to Hills and say, is that something for you to have a conversation with your residents about and see if that's even something that would be entertained," Hora said. Iowa law provides two paths for changing school boundaries. A majority of residents from both the current school district and proposed school district would have to vote to approve the changes, or both school boards would have to agree. Neither one of those paths is quick, and potential legislative changes to speed the process aren't likely to happen in the waning weeks of the 2024 legislative session, said Mark Stutzman, a Hills resident who spoke at Monday's meeting. Jody Bailey said she and other residents are forming the Hills Coalition 2.0 to help gather community input on school boundaries and potential uses for the building. Hills Mayor Tim Kemp last week asked Lone Tree Superintendent Tyler Hoetz why his district would want Hills students. Kemp joked that it felt like Hills had entered the transfer portal, a status when college athletes are looking for new schools. Hoetz said the two communities have a lot in common and that there had been interest in busing students from Hills to Lone Tree, which has about 450 students in two buildings. As for maintaining an elementary in Hills, Hoetz said more information was needed. "We want to make sure it's financially responsible for us to keep it open and what that would look like," he said. But Hills leaders and residents agree they want to regain ownership of the Hills School building, built by the Liberty Township in the 1960s and sold to the Iowa City School District for $1 when the town joined the district later that decade. "The building could be used as a child care center or for homeschooling opportunities," residents said. "We need to find out their plan for that physical structure," Speaker Ron Stutzman said of the Iowa City School District. He's heard of other districts getting federal funding to remove structures and remediate contamination to create a greenfield site desirable for new development. Iowa City Community School District spokeswoman Kristen Peterson said Tuesday the district was not asked to participate in last week's work session with lawmakers. Discussions have not yet started at the district about what to do with the Hills building. "Hills students will attend Alexander Elementary School next fall," she said. That school is 8 miles, or about 12 minutes, from the Hills school. And the last item on today's front page, Iowa House votes to crack down on traffic cameras. Cedar Rapids would need to get state okay to keep cameras, by Caleb McCullough. After years of working to regulate automated traffic enforcement cameras in Iowa, with competing opinions on how far to go, Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill Tuesday that would require state approval and restrict the cameras to certain areas. Republican state lawmakers have long sought to rein in the use of speed cameras and red light cameras that recently have proliferated across the state. Some lawmakers have argued they often are abused by local governments to drive up revenue from tickets, but police officials say they are a vital part of a public safety strategy. The bill, House File 2681, passed the House 85-12. The Senate has a similar bill that is eligible for a floor vote. The bill would require local governments to receive a permit from the Iowa Department of Transportation before installing a traffic camera system, and required that the system be installed only in high-risk areas. The city or county would need to report the severity of traffic collisions at the location it wants to install a camera and show that the camera is the least restrictive method of improving public safety. There are about 25 cities in the state with traffic cameras currently in place, according to an analysis by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Cedar Rapids operates cameras in 9 locations, and Marion operates them in 2 places. University Heights said it was installing cameras in 2 locations. Some Republican lawmakers wanted to amend the bill to ban the use of speed cameras entirely, but the measure failed to gain majority support on the floor with a vote of 47-50. Representative John Wills, Republican of Spirit Lake, introduced the amendment and said he believed the cameras are an infringement of constitutional rights. He said he has constituents who received tickets when someone else was driving their car, which he said was unfair. "These cameras are not fair. They're not something that we should be doling out justice in a way that is not fair to all of our citizens in this state," he said. "These traffic cameras are speed traps. I don't believe they're constitutional." Representative Brian Best, Republican of Glidden, who managed the House bill and opposed the ban, said the bill was a compromise that restricts unnecessary traffic cameras while allowing their use where needed. We have to do something, he said, and without this amendment and this bill, we will be doing nothing, and I think there's going to be a lot of unwanted and unneeded traffic cameras that are going to keep springing up. Democratic Representative Sammy Sheets, who represents Cedar Rapids, said the cameras on the downtown S-curve on Interstate 380 in the city have dramatically reduced injuries from collisions. The city first installed traffic cameras in 2010, including four along I-380's S-curve. According to a 2022 report from the city, the likelihood of a crash on the S-curve causing injury was cut by nearly half when a traffic camera was in use, and the number of collisions was reduced by 15.5%. This technology not only saves lives by reducing high-speed accidents, but it also protects our first responders by minimizing risky traffic stops, Sheets said. Under the bill, cities would need to gain approval from the Iowa DOT before installing traffic cameras. Cities with existing systems would need to apply for approval, but could continue using the cameras until the request is processed. Only cities or counties with a population of more than 20,000 would be allowed to use issue a fine using a traffic camera, which encompasses about 25 of Iowa's largest cities. Smaller cities still would be allowed to install traffic cameras if approved, but they could issue only a written warning. The cities would not be able to issue a ticket unless a driver was driving more than 10 miles over the speed limit, already below the standard used in Cedar Rapids and Marion, and the maximum amount would range from $75 to $500 based on the speed, or up to $1,000 in a work zone. Any revenue collected by the systems would be restricted for use on transportation infrastructure or police and fire departments. MedQuarter Plan looks to revitalize CR District by Marissa Payne. A new master plan for the MedQuarter Regional Medical District adopted Tuesday by the Cedar Rapids City Council envisions transforming empty properties, improving placemaking, and strengthening the district's identity to lure patients, healthcare providers, and businesses. To make the district more of a regional draw and community hub, the updated plan recommends changes that would infuse new life into underused properties and green space, create a stronger district brand, and promote active, healthy living. But it also underscores the need for more intensive redevelopment in the area to add new sorely needed uses to Cedar Rapids' urban core, such as a hotel. The MedQ is one of the city's three self-supported municipal improvement districts, where taxpayers within the district have authorized the city to levy an additional tax on property owners to raise revenue for specific purposes within the district's boundaries. That often includes beautification projects, streetscaping, events, and programming. The key initiatives under the previous plan had been accomplished, and the COVID-19 pandemic upended the urban core and healthcare industry. That prompted the update to the plan. The SSMID enlisted Scott Frers, president of Chicago-based Lakota Group, who helped develop a previous plan under the SSMID's formation in 2012. The previous plan was adopted in 2014. Phil Wasta, executive director of the MedQ, said this plan helps set a meaningful vision and strategy for the MedQ in the future. Frers said taking the SSMID's economic activity and packaging it with the bigger economy of what's happening in the city maximizes public benefit. In the last 10 years, there has been more than $100 million of investment across projects, including the construction of three landmark buildings, the Physicians Clinic of Iowa Medical Pavilion 2, the Jewel and Jim Plum Heart Center, and the new Cedar Rapids Bank and Trust Building. Along with streetscape enhancements along 10th Street and 1st Avenue Southeast, the district has undergone a transformation. The plan is built around five pillars: policy, management and marketing, appearance and identity, access and infrastructure, and community building. An implementation matrix identifies the partners responsible for each initiative, sets short, mid, and long-term timelines to accomplish them, and potential funding sources. Stakeholders, including the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance, City of Cedar Rapids, Crafted Coffee, the Cedar Rapids Police Department, and others, provided input to understand safety perceptions and challenges, business engagement, and other perspectives on the MedQ. Crafted operates a coffee shop inside Physicians Clinic in addition to its First Street Southeast location and wants to activate the street with a few tables, Frers said, so the plan calls for more outdoor activation. Other examples include increasing public art and using the greenway, created by 30-foot setbacks on each side of 4th Avenue Southeast, to create space for pocket parks such as the Mayo Park open space at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Similar to Cedar Rapids' newly adopted Downtown Vision Plan, the new MedQ plan calls for a strengthened relationship between public and private sectors to increase fundraising to fund improvements in the district. That would include creation of a new 501c3 nonprofit to pursue grants and other funding streams. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said the prospect of more public-private partnerships was compelling to her. To take the district to the next level, she said entities with a stake in the district need to be walking in the same direction, singing the same song. According to the plan, city leaders have interest in seeing a hotel built in the district, potentially by redeveloping empty properties. The plan indicated the owner of the 411 10th Street Southeast Medical Building, for instance, was open to potentially adding a hotel or a community open space on the property and putting excess parking on the site into better use. The plan recommends hospitality partnerships or initiatives for cross-marketing with hotels and restaurants, such as rewards programs to enhance the district's allure, not just for regional patients, but also for visitors and healthcare professionals. As the SSMID looks toward reconstitution in 2032, that could offer an opportunity to potentially modify boundaries and add entities such as Coe College within the SSMID. The plan recommends engaging with Coe and adjacent landowners to explore potential district expansion opportunities and partnerships, and studying fiscal impacts to the SSMID in doing so. Layoffs, part of University of Iowa transition of rape victim services, by Vanessa Miller. With roots reaching into the same University of Iowa soil, a pair of Iowa City-based victim service agencies are joining forces 50-plus years later, but doing so apart from the campus, where both began in the 1970s, leaving some employees without jobs in the streamlining of operations. The university has agreed to merge its 51-year-old rape victim advocacy program with the Iowa City-based domestic violence intervention program, which was started after the UI's Women's Resource and Action Center in 1977 landed a grant to explore the issue of domestic violence in the community. While DVIP will continue offering services for victims of intimate partner violence, the program by September 30th will add in the sexual assault support services RVAP has offered since its founding in 1973. The change, put simply, made sense, according to leaders of both organizations. RVAP and DVIP are both longstanding agencies, UI Vice President for Student Life Sarah Hansen said in a statement, referencing the group's similarities, including they both provide free and confidential services to the same 8-county region in southeast Iowa. Our shared goal is to position RVAP to thrive in the 8-county region it serves through this transition to DVIP, Hansen said. The UI will continue to partner with and support RVAP, DVIP, both monetarily and through collaborative approaches to end sexual and domestic violence. The university has not provided the Gazette with a copy of an agreement to transition RVAP services to DVIP. When asked how much the university will pay DVIP for absorbing RVAP services, officials said the university will provide funding for specific advocate and prevention work. The details are still being determined. The university did confirm that through the transition, 12 current UI RVAP employees will lose their jobs, according to the UI Office of Strategic Communication. Iowa Senate passes bill to help Boy Scout abuse victims. Bill extending statute of limitations for survivors now heads to the House, by Tom Barton. The Iowa Senate unanimously passed a bill Tuesday that would temporarily lift the state's statute of limitations for filing civil claims on sexual abuse to allow Iowa victims to receive full compensation from a national settlement with the Boy Scouts of America. Senate File 2431 now heads to the Iowa House for consideration. Lawmakers face a ticking clock. Iowa has 1 year from the effective date of the settlement trust, by April 19th, to change the law, or else Iowa survivors will receive less than others across the country, according to an attorney involved in the matter. That means lawmakers must pass and Governor Kim Reynolds must sign the bill into law before then for survivors to receive the larger amount. Although this is not going to be able to take away the true pain that happened years ago, hopefully this will give a little bit of relief for their lives going forward, said Senator Tim Crayenbrink, Republican of Fort Dodge, the bill's floor manager. The bill temporarily would lift the state statute of limitations so that victims of sexual abuse while in the Boy Scouts can receive damages from the Scouting Settlement Trust, a $2.5 billion fund established last year after the Scouts filed for bankruptcy protection. The Scouts filed for bankruptcy in 2020 after several states enacted laws letting accusers sue over decades-old abuse allegations. The organization ultimately reached a settlement approved in court in 2022 that would pay abuse victims amounts ranging from $3,500 to $2.7 million, for claims against the Boy Scouts of America, as well as all claims against local Boy Scout councils and supporting organizations. The settlement involves more than 82,000 men who said they were abused as children by troop leaders. That fund, the largest of its kind in U.S. history to settle sexual abuse claims, began distributing payments last fall to victims. But unless Iowa legislators take action in the next few weeks, the estimated roughly 300 to 350 Iowans involved in the settlement will receive a fraction of the awards they otherwise would be entitled to. When figuring compensation, the settlement uses a matrix that weighs a variety of factors, including a state civil statute of limitations. Iowa statute of limitations requires victims of child sexual abuse to file cases in district courts by the age of 19 or within 4 years of coming to the realization as an adult that their injuries and suffering are related to their alleged abuse. Because of Iowa's short statute of limitations, victims in the state could see their financial compensation from the Scouts reduced by 60% to 70% compared with victims in other states, according to an attorney. Cray and Brink said lawmakers were working on a companion bill in the House to ensure the measure makes it to Reynolds' desk in time. The governor told reporters last week she's open to supporting the bill. Iowa City Police investigating report of gunfire by Emily Anderson. The Iowa City Police Department responded early Tuesday to a shots fired call in the area of Walden Road and Sylvan Glen Court, according to the department. The call came at 2:01 a.m. Tuesday. Police found evidence of shots fired in the 2400 block of Walden Road. Police asked anyone in the area who has a security camera to review footage and contact police at 319-356-5275 if they find anything that shows the incident. Eminent domain bill advances in the Senate. Unlike House, Senate has been hesitant to take up such legislation. By Aaron Murphy. Iowa landowners would have an additional legal avenue to protest their land being used with the government's blessing for a private company's hazardous liquid pipeline under legislation that advanced Tuesday in the Iowa Senate. The proposal was approved earlier this year by the full Iowa House, where Republicans had been vocal proponents of reining in the use of eminent domain for private projects, such as the carbon dioxide capture pipelines that have been proposed in Iowa. The Iowa Senate, on the other hand, has been far more hesitant to take action on eminent domain since the pipeline projects were announced, until Tuesday. The Senate has a few different views within the Republican caucus that are not unreasonable. Senator Jason Schultz, a Republican from Schleswig, who conducted a hearing on the bill Tuesday at the Iowa Capitol, told reporters, "I respect my colleagues, and they've got some issues broader with the bill," Schultz said, listing opposition points like deference to current processes for challenging eminent domain and support for the CO2 pipeline projects by corn growers and renewable fuels advocates. "We have respectable positions that we've all looked at each other and expressed and exchanged. I'm going to respect those, but I have mine, and I think landowner rights and eminent domain rise right to the top." The bill would allow individuals or companies to ask a court to review whether forced easements are warranted in a pending pipeline case. Supporters said it would expand the rights of landowners and clear up constitutional questions about eminent domain authority for hazardous liquid pipelines. Roughly 20 landowners spoke during Tuesday's hearing, some through tears as they described their attempts to prevent a pipeline from going through their property. All three members of the panel considering the bill Tuesday, Republican Senators Schultz and Dan Dawson and Democratic Senator Herman Kornbach, signed off on advancing it. It is now eligible for consideration by the Senate Committee on Tax Policy. Schultz said the proposal will need changes if it has a chance to pass the Senate. He said one element that has to be altered would allow landowners to start a new lawsuit if more than 18 months have passed since a previous legal challenge. Schultz said that would enable individuals to delay pipeline projects indefinitely. "That's poor policy. I don't like the pipeline project going forward, but at the same time, we're not here to just give a backdoor killer bill. I want good policy," Schultz said. The bill previously passed the House 86-7. All present Democrats voted in favor, and 7 Republicans voted no. Both chambers must approve the bill before it can be sent to Governor Kim Reynolds for her consideration. Reynolds has not said whether she would sign eminent domain restrictions. Law boosts oversight of foreign-owned farmland. "American soil belongs in American hands," Reynolds says during ceremony, by Tom Barton. Foreign owners of Iowa farmland will face new disclosure requirements and penalties for not complying under legislation signed into law Tuesday by Governor Kim Reynolds. Reynolds signed Senate File 2204, which adds transparency requirements for foreign ownership of Iowa farmland, citing a growing concern about Chinese investment in U.S. agriculture. The measure, which Reynolds called for in her annual condition of the state address in January, sailed through the legislature with unanimous support in February. When Iowa speaks, the country listens, and with this bill, our message is unmistakable. American soil belongs in American hands, Reynolds, a Republican, said during the bill signing. Iowa is among several states that already have limits on foreign ownership of land. State law restricts foreign farmland purchases to 320 acres, although foreign owners who held Iowa farmland before 1980 were allowed to keep it. The new law requires foreign landowners to provide more information to the state and grants the state attorney general broader authority to subpoena financial records and purchase agreements to investigate potential violations of foreign farmland ownership. It also raises financial penalties for violations and requires the Iowa Secretary of State's office to increase its tracking of foreign ownership. The Secretary of State would be required to file an annual report on foreign farmland ownership in Iowa, which would be made available to state officials, but not the public. Foreign landowners will be required to provide details about all of their holdings in the state that exceed 250 acres. Failing to disclose purchases or leases of agricultural land by a foreign entity will result in a fine of up to 25% of the property's value per violation. Previously, the law called for a fine of no more than $2,000 per violation. Failing to report holdings once every 2 years will result in a penalty of up to $10,000 per violation. Cedar Rapids Schools begin design of new college and career academies by Grace King. Independence-based Larson Construction Company was hired Monday night by the Cedar Rapids Schools to consult through the design, construction, and completion of renovations at three of the district's high schools that will support college and career academies and pathways. Expanding college and career education has been a focus of Cedar Rapids school leaders for the last year and is part of the district's strategic plan to better prepare students for high-wage, high-skill, and in-demand careers after high school. "We're talking about school for the future," Superintendent Tawana Grover said Monday. "People want adaptability, they want choice, they want personal attention and innovation. And that's why we're trying to design a system that will allow for that." The district is preparing to launch freshman academies at Jefferson, Kennedy, and Washington High Schools for the 2025-26 school year. An academy has a college and career theme and prepares students for post-secondary options and careers. The following year, the 2026-27 school year, the district will launch upper academies for sophomores, juniors, and seniors. In the contract with Larson Construction, unanimously approved by the school board, the company will consult with the district through design, construction, and completion of the projects, lead and manage the design process, develop bid packages, bid the project, and lead the construction process. The consultant services from Larson is estimated to cost the district 1.5%, and pre-construction services is estimated at 2.75% of an estimated $30 million construction budget. When the district enters the construction phase, Larson's construction manager's fee will be billed hourly. Last month, a team of architects, including a representative from Larson Construction, toured all 32 schools in the Cedar Rapids Community School District as the first step in creating a new facility plan before the district takes another general obligation bond referendum to voters. The last bond referendum, a $220 million ask, was turned down by district voters in November 2023. Bill regulating nuisance strip clubs advances. The Iowa Senate passed a bill that would allow cities to limit the hours of strip clubs they determined to be a danger to public safety. Large cities in Iowa, led by Davenport, have pushed for the bill in the wake of recent shootings. The bill, House File 2531, would allow a county attorney or city attorney to sue a strip club and request a court order to limit the hours from noon to 10 p.m. if they determine the club is a public safety nuisance. The court also could prohibit alcohol there. An establishment could be considered a public safety nuisance if someone on or near the establishment fires a gun, assaults another person with a dangerous weapon, or engages in a riot on three or more times within a year. A court could impose additional sanctions after trial if it determines a public safety nuisance exists. The bill now heads back to the Iowa House for final passage. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 10, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Janice C. DeVries, 82, of Marion, died Monday, April 8th at St. Luke's Hospital following an extended illness. Visitation will be held from 5 until 7 p.m. Thursday, April 11th at the Getch Funeral Home, Anamosa. There will be private family graveside services at the Green Center Cemetery in Morley. Edwin Andre Vassar Jr., age 60, of Cedar Rapids, passed away suddenly on Tuesday, April 2nd at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held at New City Church on Sunday, April 14th, 5 to 7 p.m. A funeral service at the church will follow on Monday, April 15th at 11 a.m., interment at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. He was born on July 27, 1963, in Chicago to Edwin Andre Vassar Sr. and Gwendolyn Cates. Edwin was a graduate of Washington High School class of 1981. He proudly served as a surveyor in the Army and later pursued a career at Farmstead Foods. Passionate about entrepreneurship, Edwin ventured into independent construction, showcasing his talent for working with his hands and his knack for numbers. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to a memorial fund at BMO Bank under Edwin Vassar Memorial Fund. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. Alan B. Moy, MD, of Iowa City, died at home Monday, April 8th, with his wife by his side after a long illness. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 13th, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Iowa City, where a parish rosary will be said beginning at 10 a.m. The Mass will be followed by a lunch reception and time of visitation prior to burial at St. Joseph's Cemetery. For a complete obituary, to share a thought, memory, or condolence with his family, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service website at gayandchia.com. Evelyn Barger, widow of Kenneth Barger of Cedar Rapids, died April 8th. Visitation, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, 3 to 5 p.m., Sunday, April 14th. Memorial Service, St. Pius X Church, Monday, April 15th. Greet family, 10 to 11 a.m., with Mass beginning at 11. For full obituary, visit cedarmemorial.com. David Bright of Iowa City died Monday, April 8th. David attended St. Mary's Regina and graduated from West High School and the University of Iowa. David started at UPS in college, first working the 4 a.m. preload and later driving for Big Brown. He was conscientious, putting his customers first. He enjoyed the city routes with regular customers, and for the decades he was driving, UPS grew larger with each year he was there. He loved UPS and had a great work ethic. After he retired from UPS, Dave was a dear friend and dedicated member of the Kirkwood Community College's Iowa City campus, and is profoundly missed. Dave's tenure at Kirkwood was defined by his unwavering commitment to Kirkwood's mission and his positive impact on students and colleagues alike. The family will greet friends at the Kirkwood Room from 10:30 a.m. to noon, Friday, April 12th. A rosary will be said at 11 a.m., followed by a brief service led by Father Ed Fitzpatrick. Online condolences may be shared at lensingfuneral.com. Mary Teresa Harris, 73, of Frisco, Texas, died at her home Wednesday, March 27th, after a hard-fought battle with cancer. Mary and John Harris married on January 10th, 1970, and began a family. They moved to Missouri, and Mary studied nursing and started a career as an LPN. Her greatest love was her family. She loved being with her family and watching her grandchildren grow into their own. The celebration of life will be held in Mary's honor on Saturday, April 27th from 3 to 5:30 p.m. at Frisco Lakes Community Center in Frisco, Texas. In lieu of flowers, please send a donation for cancer research in Mary's honor. Mickey Ray Neal, 82, of Marion, passed away Sunday, April 7th at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, April 12th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service, beginning at 10 a.m. Mick was born September 27, 1941, to Roy and Effie Reed Neal in Weldon, Iowa. After he graduated from high school, he enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. He married Charlene Haney on October 13, 1962, in Cedar Rapids, and together they had three children. He worked 20 years at Lefebure and later retired from Schneider Electric. He enjoyed traveling, working on small engines, walking his dog Charlie, and helping people. Mick's biggest joy was his wife and spending time with his family. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. Larry Lyle Bowers, 90, of Center Point, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away from this life on Monday, April 8th at his home, surrounded by his family. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, April 15th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, where a visitation will begin at 10 a.m., 1 hour prior to the service. Reverend Casey Reinkoster will officiate. Burial with military honors will follow at Dunkard Cemetery in Toddville. Larry entered the world on June 28, 1933 in Cedar Rapids, the son of Henry and Irene Thayer Bowers. On October 21, 1950, Larry was united in marriage to the love of his life, Mary Lou Williams, at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. Larry served in the United States Army for 3 years until he was honorably discharged in January of 1954. He retired from Iowa Manufacturing and went on to work at Physicians Clinic of Iowa and continued until he turned 80 years old. He was a member of the First Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. Memorials in Larry's memory may be directed to the family to be designated later. Please share a memory of Larry at murdochfuneralhome.com. Marilyn Ann Wickman of Homestead was born February 4, 1941 in Williamsburg to John T. and Olga Heitzhusen and Werner. Her love for our Savior began at Emmanuel Lutheran Church near Williamsburg, where she was baptized on March 2, 1941, attended school, and was confirmed June 6, 1954. Marilyn went on to graduate from Williamsburg High School in 1958 and completed a one-year licensed practical nursing program at the State University of Iowa in Iowa City. Marilyn met the love of her life, Earl Wayne Wickman. They were united in marriage at Emmanuel Lutheran Church on October 30, 1960. Following their marriage, they made their home on the family farm near Homestead, where they raised their four children. Marilyn was dedicated to the care of others as she worked as a nurse in Amana and Williamsburg clinics. She was an active member of St. John's Lutheran Church in Homestead, where she served as a Sunday school teacher and junior high youth group leader. She participated in Ladies Aid, LWML, and the church choir. Services will be 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, April 11th at St. John's Lutheran Church near Homestead. Burial will be in the St. John Lutheran Cemetery. Visitation will be Wednesday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. A memorial fund has been established for the Lutheran Interparish School or St. John Lutheran Church. The service will be live streamed and messages and tributes may be directed to powellfuneralhomes.com. Stanley Rabick, 97, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, April 7th. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, April 10th. At Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held at 1:30 p.m. on Thursday, April 11th at the funeral home. Entombment at Czech National Cemetery in Cedar Rapids will take place at a later date. Stanley was born April 16, 1926 in Center Point, the son of Wesley and Frances Callista Rabick. He was united in marriage to Frieda Iris Tompkins on March 10, 1946 in Cedar Rapids. Stanley dedicated 39 years of service to the city of Cedar Rapids before his retirement at age 62. He enjoyed hunting, fishing, and traveling. Memorials may be directed to the family. Please share a memory of Stanley at murdochfuneralhome.com. Joan Margaret Colvin Koch, 89, of Clarence, passed away on April 6th from complications of cancer. Joan was born on August 3, 1934 in rural Taylor County, Kentucky, to parents R. Marriott and Margaret A. McDermott Colvin. She attended Taylor County High School in Campbellsville, where she excelled in athletics and graduated in 1950 at the age of 16. Soon after graduation, she took a job with the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington, D.C. as a tracer clerk, receiving special consideration due to her age. She was a catcher for the league champion FBI softball team. There she met her future husband, who also worked in the Bureau as a clerk supervisor. They were married on April 10, 1953, and soon after moved to Cedar Rapids, eventually to Stanwood in 1957. While raising their four sons, she worked part-time as a secretary at Lincoln High School and as the city clerk of Stanwood. She retired as clerk in 1997 after 29 years with the city and later served 4 years on the city council. A graveside committal service will be conducted by Pastor Watkins of St. Paul's Lutheran Church at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 13th at the Stanwood Cemetery. A luncheon will be provided for family and friends after the service at the Masonic Lodge in Stanwood. The family asks that no flowers be sent and that any memorials be directed to the Clarence Nursing Home and be noted Koch Memorial for staff. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving to today's opinion page, there are three letters to the editor today. Here is the first one from Carol Wagers of Cedar Rapids. Avoid drivers with Don't Tread on Me license plates. Instead of grants from the Department of Public Safety for gun rights education, I think it would be much more appropriate to dedicate any funds raised from sales of the Gadsden flag license plate to victims of gun violence. However, I do see one important benefit of this legislation. When we see this license plate displayed on cars in our area, we will know that the drivers of those cars are, we can carefully avoid any contact with them. That's a letter from Carol Wagers of Cedar Rapids. Here's the second letter. It is from Hal Penick of Iowa City. Still no audit report from Iowa Attorney General. It has been over a year since Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd announced that the state would no longer pay for any type of emergency contraception or abortion treatment for victims of sexual assault until she completed a top-down, bottom-up audit of victim assistance. At the time of the announcement, the backlog of requests for crime victim compensation funds totaled approximately $7,500. To date, no audit report has been released, but the AG office says it is in the final stages and will be released soon. It appears to me that Byrd has embraced the same auditing process that former President Trump used for years to avoid releasing his tax returns. That's a letter from Hal Penick of Iowa City in today's Gazette. Here's the third one. It is from David Mansheim of Parkersburg. If I only were an Iowa legislator. I wish I were an Iowa legislator. They become so wise upon arriving at the Capitol in Des Moines. I could while away the hours and then just automatically know more history and civics than any professor. I would be able to write better curricula than any educator, more than any philosopher, theologian, or physician as to when life begins. The difference between a man and a woman, but not the difference between a chicken and an egg. Good Samaritans should be arrested in Iowa for helping undocumented immigrants. To give hungry kids food will just make them fat. Smaller government and more guns will make us safe. Trans kids and global warming are hoaxes, but voter fraud and critical race theory are threats. Iowans don't want more public lands, nursing home inspectors, or clean waterways because they want lower taxes. We can underfund education in Iowa and rob public schools to pay private schools. We hate cancel culture, but diversity, equity, and inclusion are terrible ideas that need to be stamped out of our universities. We don't trust teachers to teach, but we trust them to carry guns in the classroom. Lawmakers don't need to campaign on programs they will advance if elected because voters don't care. Iowa needs more hog confinement facilities, more gambling, and less local control by local governments. With the thoughts I'd be thinking, I could be another Lincoln. If only I were a legislator. That's a letter in today's Gazette from David Mansheim of Parkersburg. Here is a guest column in today's paper by Art Cullen. Its headline is Farm Girls Have Been Scorching the Nets for a Century. Caitlin Clark first caught America's attention with her dazzling trays from the beak of the tiger hawk at center court of Carver Hawkeye Arena, the University of Iowa. She sold out arenas from Minneapolis to State College, Pennsylvania, on her way to becoming the all-time NCAA scoring leader. She can see the floor like Magic Johnson and understands the game like John Wooden, which made her a passing genius and a rebounding machine. This was the year the USA went nuts for women's hoops. Sunday's NCAA Women's Basketball Championship game, in which South Carolina beat Iowa, smashed the glass ceilings in terms of television viewing. But girls have been playing against and inside the barns out here in the cornfields of the Midwest for more than a century to popular acclaim. We have three hobbies in Iowa: complaining about the weather and politics, grilling pork burgers, and watching basketball on TV. The major cultural events of the year are the Iowa State Fair in the summer and the girls' basketball and boys' wrestling tournaments in the winter. Long before Clark, there was Denise Long of Whitten, population 200, who scored 6,250 points in 4 years of high school, 6-on-6 girls basketball. That's right, up until the 1980s, most Iowa girls played with each team having three guards on defense and three forwards on offense, and never the twain shall cross the half-court line. Each player was limited to two dribbles per possession. It was weird but entertainingly high-scoring, and the fans loved it. Long scored 93 points in a 1968 girls state tourney game at Veterans Memorial Auditorium, the Big Barn, in Des Moines. She was drafted in the 13th round by the San Francisco Warriors of the NBA in 1969, the first woman ever, but was not allowed to play. Only Hayseeds Long in the Tooth would recall the classic matchup between Long and Jeanette Olson of the Everly Cattle Feederettes in the 1968 championship. Olson averaged 59 points per game that year while wearing a uniform with a pleated skirt, and Long averaged 69 wearing shorts. Long's Union Whitten squad prevailed 113-107 in overtime. Long was eclipsed only in 1987 by Lynn Lorenzen of Ventura, who set the 6-on-6 high school scoring record at 6,736 points. And then there was Machine Gun Molly Boleyn of Moravia, the queen of the short-lived Iowa Cornets in the Women's Professional Basketball League. In 1979, she put up 55 points in one game and averaged 32 per game. She was featured in Sports Illustrated. The six-girl high school sport finally gave way to five-girl teams in the smallest schools in the 1990s, but the devotion to stroking the nets remained. Cracker box gyms and high schools with 120 students still nearly blow up on Tuesday and Friday nights. The entire state watches the championships on public television. We had all heard about Caitlin Clark of West Des Moines Dowling, a Catholic school, years ago. Her college coach, Lisa Bluder, became a household name while leading the Drake University Bulldogs to national prominence before decamping to Iowa City. Bluder's top assistant, Jan Jensen, was a star from Elkhorn Kimbleton, enrollment 188, and led the nation in scoring at Drake. Midwestern attention to women's sports has always been keen. Dr. James Naismith seeded basketball in Kansas, but it was cultivated by and for women in Iowa, we tell ourselves. Although we like to think of our game as superior, the same could be said for Kansas and Indiana, even Nebraska. It comes as some comfort that we rural folk might not be as backward as you are led to believe. The Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union was formed in 1925 because rural schools had a girls' basketball Jones. The big city snoots thought it was unladylike, but the bumpkins knew a good game when they saw one. Nowadays, the girls wrestle, too. It's a big hit. Farm girls in the little school started it. A few glass breakers started by grappling with the boys, then got a girls' sport of their own to keep the boys from embarrassment. If women can slop hogs or milk cows or harvest corn, they sure can play basketball or wrestle. Or be governor, as Republican Kim Reynolds is, or a U.S. senator, as Republican Joni Ernst is. Republican Brenna Byrd is attorney general. They are all bona fide conservatives. Reynolds and Byrd favor an abortion ban at 6 weeks, for example. They all came up in a state that has been nuts for girls' sports for at least a century, and where a woman in coveralls and three-buckle overshoes could deal in town on a pickup or corn sheller like any man could. They've been running courthouses and telling the men in the on the county board how to do it since at least the days of the Everly cattle feederettes. The girls got game. Now everybody knows. Art Cullen is editor of the Storm Lake Times Pilot in Northwest Iowa. He wrote this for the Washington Post. Here are a couple of items I didn't have time for in the first half from today's Capital Notebook feature. Reynolds rejects tweaks to AEA law by the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. Governor Kim Reynolds rebuffed calls Tuesday for changes to the law she signed last month overhauling the state's special education providers, as some House lawmakers want to change what they saw as an oversight in the bill they passed. The new law changes the funding structures and oversight of the state's area education agencies, which provide special education support, media services, and other services to school districts. Making changes to the AEAs was Reynolds' top legislative priority, though the final law differed significantly from her proposal. Once fully implemented, the law will require school districts to spend 90% of their special education funding with an AEA, while they will have discretion over the other 10%. But for the other AEA functions, for media and other educational services, by the second year, school districts will receive the full amount currently going to the AEAs, about $68 million. Districts will have broad flexibility over the spending. They can contract with the AEAs for those services, seek them from another vendor, or put the money in their general fund to spend in other areas. Now, some House Republicans are saying that was an oversight and are looking to change the law to require the money to be spent on the intended services, the Des Moines Register first reported. Speaking with reporters, Reynolds said she does not support any change to the legislation. She said schools should be allowed to spend media and education service dollars how they see fit. "I'm absolutely not," Reynolds said when asked if she was open to changes. "That was the deal. First of all, it's about local control. They know best what's important for the kids in their district, and so they're going to decide how to use that money, and that's how it should always be." Representative Brent Segrist, Republican of Council Bluffs, who previously led the Iowa Association of Area Education Agencies, said he and some other lawmakers want spending from those sources to be restricted only to the services they're currently intended for, while still allowing school districts to seek those services outside an AEA. That change could be made by inserting the language into budget bills. It's unclear whether House leadership will make that move, and Segrist said he is not sure the Senate would pass it anyway. Sheriff's retirement changes. Senate lawmakers advanced a House bill Tuesday that would make changes to the Iowa Public Employees Retirement System for sheriffs and deputies, including increasing the applicable percentage for retirement benefit payments. It also would provide that a person charged with the murder or felony assault of a law enforcement or corrections officer is not eligible for bail, and it would create a tax credit of up to $2,000 for public safety officers moving into Iowa. House File 2661 increases the maximum IPERS retirement benefit from 72 to 80% and establishes an annual 1.5% cost of living adjustment to the monthly allowance for sheriff and deputy sheriff members of IPERS for retirements on or after July 1st. Representatives for the Iowa State Association of Counties and Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association spoke in favor of the legislation, saying it will help recruitment and retention efforts. The bill passed the House last month with a vote of 93-0. It now moves to the Senate Ways and Means Committee for consideration. Moving on to sports, here's today's article about Iowa football. It's titled Moss 2.0 Energy. Soon-to-be soft nester draws comparisons to former Big Ten Defensive Back of the Year by John Stepp. John Nestor has a lot of energy everywhere he goes. As soon as he wakes up, probably, until he goes to bed, he's just super energetic, Xavier Nwankpa said of his fellow Iowa defensive back. I don't know how he does it. Long before his time in a Hawkeye uniform as he grew up in Chicago, that energy led to some early mornings for Nestor and his father. 5 a.m., I'd be waking him up like, "Dad, Dad, let's go, we got football," Nestor said as he talked at a fervent pace. "Let's go, let's go." Fast forward to the spring after his true freshman season, his first spring with the Hawkeyes, and Nestor's energy seems to be netting early results. Nestor was one of 10 true freshmen at Iowa to see game action last season, and he was one of only two freshmen to play in 4-plus games and therefore exercise a year of eligibility. He's drawing comparisons to former Iowa and current NFL cornerback Riley Moss. Coach kind of joked around and said he reminds him of Riley, how he moves on the field, cornerback Deshaun Lee told reporters on Tuesday. It's not just Iowa's coaching staff that sees a bit of Moss in Nestor. "I really see a Riley Moss," said Nwankpa, former 5-star recruit from Pleasant Hill. "They have similar movements on the field, kind of act the same off the field. It's kind of weird seeing how they align so easily." Considering that Moss was the 2021 Big Ten Defensive Back of the Year and a third-round selection in the 2023 NFL Draft, it is a comparison Nestor will happily accept. "Being compared to Riley Moss is such a high honor," Nestor said. "Riley Moss is one of the guys that everybody looks to in our program, especially in the defensive back room. At the same time, I got to build my own future. I have my own path." Nestor's own path perhaps bears some resemblance to a young Phil Parker as well. "Coach Parker comes to practice with an intensity and passion every day unmatched," Nestor said of Iowa's longtime defensive coordinator and defensive backs coach. "So in my eyes, I just try to match it and exceed that passion and energy." When Nestor arrived at Iowa, he had the expectation for himself to play. "But you got to learn, too," Nestor said. "Playing comes with learning and messing up and taking the losses, too." His top goal of the week each week eventually became travel. When the Hawkeyes headed east for the Penn State game on September 23rd, Nestor earned a spot on the travel roster. "It was good to see, but also that wasn't my end goal," Nestor said. "I was like, okay, cool, I'm traveling. But now, what's the next step? What's the next goal?" His 142 snaps as a true freshman, according to Pro Football Focus, were exclusively on special teams. That gave Nestor an opportunity as well as some motivation. "I love playing on special teams, and Coach LeVar Woods is such a good coach," Nestor said. "He really gives you the tools to succeed, just like every coach in our building. But it was also good for me because I wasn't on the defensive field and I wanted to be, okay, what can I do more to get on the defensive field? How can I show on special teams my energy, my effort?" Now in spring practices, Nestor has been working at both cornerback and cash safety during spring practices. "Cash has been really good for me," said Nestor, who is listed at 5'11" and 196 pounds. "It's such a position that you got to be able to play in the box, play in the coverage. It's definitely a versatile position." The cash position is considered appealing considering Parker's history of sending cash safeties to the NFL, whether it be Imani Hooker, Dane Belton, or others. Playing cash, Iowa's hybrid safety position, also could be another avenue for his goal of getting defensive playing time on a secondary with plenty of returning talent. Iowa's secondary returns 4 defensive backs with 14 or more career starts, safeties Quinn Schulte, Sebastian Castro, and Nwankpa, and cornerback Jamari Harris, and a 5th defensive back, Lee, with 6 career starts. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.